We have brands that go in and spend $80,000, $200,000 on the retheme and then just let the retheme sit and don't test on top of it because, well, I just paid all this money to the agency to do this amazing work. And if I do want to test, well, really, shouldn't I be having the agency run the test because they know what the aesthetic should be and they know what the front end design is?
It's the E-commerce Master Plan Podcast. Here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. In this episode, we're revealing a brand new type of episode. Yes, 10 years in and we've done a little bit of newness. Rather than our guests discussing what they have done, they'll be sharing what they would do. So we're calling these the WWYDs or the What Would You Do episodes. In this case, we've got regular guest, possibly our most regular guest, Ian Leslie, back on the show to share what he'd do if he were to take over an e-commerce business in the $10 to $25 million range. And we'll be talking through what Ian would do when he took it over in order to achieve a level of hockey stick growth, so fast growth within this business. I'm hoping the What Would You Do episodes give us a chance to get deep into the strategic decision-making that goes on behind the scenes, the real, less shiny, more fundamental stuff that people will do and tackle, whilst also learning some hot new strategies into the mix as well. So please do let me know what you think about this new format. The easiest option is to leave us a review. Just go to ecmp.info/review to find out how to do that. Ian and I will be discussing how he would take over and take to a point of success an e-commerce business in the $10 to $25 million turnover range. And we will be getting deep into cutting costs and also getting into testing. Testing. You have to listen to understand all of that. This might be a new episode format, but we have not dropped the top tip section. They are still there. And Ian's come up with some absolutely lovely juicy ones for you. So make sure you listen to the end to get all of that. Running ads across a broad channel mix, but unsure where to invest your next pound? Alvi helps e-commerce experts like you with full funnel attribution, budget allocation, and automated bidding towards real business outcomes. So you can stop guessing and start scaling. Take children's clothing retailer POP, for example, who saw a 27% increase in average order value after implementing Alvi's bidding signals. Do you want similar results? Then go to ecmp.info/Alvi and book your demo. Make sure you add the note e-commerce master plan when you book to get your 3-month free trial. That's ecmp.info/Alvi to book your demo. ecmp.info/Alvie. And now to introduce our special guest. Ian Leslie is an e-commerce CMO who's done stints in SaaS marketing, journalism, and education, probably best known for his 10 years driving 15x e-commerce revenue growth at B2B e-commerce furniture brand Industry West, where, as regular listeners to this show will know, he was always up to something different with his marketing budget that almost always paid off. Hello, Ian.
Hey, so good to be here. Thank you.
Always cool to have you on the show, especially cool to have you here to kick off our brand new, revolutionary new content format, the What Would You Do episode.
What Would You Do? Excellent. So exciting.
You were last on the show in December, which feels about a million years ago. So how has 2025 been going? What's been going on?
It's been interesting here in the US and internationally. I think a lot of us in e-commerce are dealing with an interesting economy and tariffs and such. So yeah, it's been an interesting, I guess, now 9 months. But most of that, the early part of 2025, I was still with Industry West, stepped away over the summer. So I'm no longer with Industry West. But I think overall, it's been no different for me than a lot of other people in the space. That I could just say it's been interesting. I think we're all kind of trying to figure it out and try to figure out the global marketplace.
The ever-changing global marketplace. Well, I do wonder, does the global marketplace factor into your what would you do? We'll find out as we continue this chat, but tell us what your what would you do is.
What would I do? So, I mean, I think I've recently been called a builder multiple times over the past 2 or 3 weeks. That's my sweet spot is building things. So my what would you do is I would start with a $10 to $20 million e-commerce company and look to build it further.
So are we talking like a doubling in 2 years or a bootstrapped growth, or what sort of build would you want to do with that business you take over?
That's a great question. I would definitely think bootstrap growth, but with like a high curve. You know, I think one of the amazing things about Industry West was that it was always privately held. So it was always bootstrap growth, but that did not get in the way of us often seeing a hockey stick of growth. Does that reference work in the UK? I don't even
know. Yeah, that does work in the UK. It does. I think the economists have stolen the hockey stick. So you're good.
Okay, there you go. But yeah, so I mean, I think you can walk and chew gum a bit with that. I often use like the wash and wear metaphor, and I wouldn't want to wash and wear. Like I would want to continue to grow and continue to build and continue to like see it grow and not just build a company to then sit by and just let it kind of coast.
Nice. So pragmatic growth, do we say in the world of bootstrapping?
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
But not as dull as the word programmatic. Where did that come from, Clay? As the word... pragmatic suggests.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't even know if I can really define pragmatic. Yeah, pragmatic growth sounds fair. You mentioned my SaaS experience. I mean, I've been part of companies on the SaaS side that were literally just throw good money after bad and just get as many eyes on your product as you can, even though if they weren't necessarily going to be, you know, good customers or good users of the product, which made absolutely no sense. So I've never been like a just spend for no good reason kind of marketer. But I think like, on the other hand, I've also been like, you find a good formula, then why not spend to the extent that you can? Like if it's working, if you're seeing 15x, like keep pouring money into that.
So you've taken over, acquired a $10 to $25 million business that you're going to be bootstrapping, but aiming for hockey stick growth within that.
Yeah.
Hard task you are setting yourself here, but obviously you've done your due diligence. So what's the first thing you do? Is it dive into the marketing and work on that? Is it work on another area of the business? Where's the area that's going to get your focus first?
Oh, yeah. But I think yes on all of that. But I think my first task would be like two things, I guess. On the marketing side, if I'm acquiring this, it would be a brand that I think has energy, looks good, has a spot in the marketplace. And like, it probably won't be something where I'm just trying to totally rebuild a website or anything. So my first thing would be like test. I definitely in the past, I'd say month to 2 months, have really kicked myself on what I thought testing was, is not what I was doing. So like running one or two A/B tests is not testing. And I think like I've learned, and some of that has been in some of my contract work over the past month or two, is that like you could be testing like 15 things on your website at the same time and really not run into any kind of data integrity issue. The tests are randomized properly. I think like test. There are so many tools out there right now, and I'm going to save mine for the tool tips part, but there's so many tools out there right now where you can be, you know, just testing across the entire funnel and, you know, testing copy, testing image, testing colors, testing recommendations. So I would say like definitely be testing constantly and really have a good CRO plan in place. The other piece I think is just overhead is, you know, what are we spending on everything that is not marketing and sales and product, and really diving really deep into that? I think there's a lot of thought boys on the social media who are, you know, how I ran this company with two people and a lot of SaaS. And often even I want to look at that and be like, really? Like, did you? But then I often think like, yeah, really, you can. Like, I don't think the companies have to be as large in terms of overhead as sometimes you think it needs to be. So I think looking at cutting a lot of that cost and reinvesting it into product and marketing and sales are the two places I would start.
Oh, so much to unpack there. First off, thank you for being such a professional podcast guest that you've already teed up the fact that people need to listen to the end to find out those door recommendations. So loving that. And then I think your point about the overhead and actually the testing as well is seeing how someone else does it can also burst your limiting beliefs. You know, like on the testing front, you thought like we're running two at a time, that's fine. You get to go and do some contracting work and peek behind someone else's curtain. All of a sudden it's like, oh man, we could have been doing 15 if we'd have deployed this and this and this. And then on the overhead stuff, it's like, yeah, those guys who were, you know, as you said, were two people, all SaaS, growing to crazy numbers. They're an outlier, but there's still a lot we can all learn from. And I think it does attack those limiting beliefs of going, well, of course I have to have someone doing that. But do you? Is that 5% of the job that you can't automate worth having someone doing 100% of the job? So would it mainly be headcount that was the target for your overhead cutting, or would it be other things as well? Like, would you switch to a 3PL instead of in-house fulfillment or anything like that?
Yes, again, to all of it. Obviously, I think it depends on what the vertical is. So without getting into too much, I guess, specifics, yeah, I think there's a lot of efficiency in 3PL as opposed to in-house. I think it depends at what revenue band you're at. But I think in that, as you're growing in that mid-20s, it makes sense to be at a 3PL. I mean, I think it just depends, especially with AI tools. And like, I don't want to get too far down the path of like, and I don't want people coming after me, like graphic designers are going to lose jobs and copywriters are losing jobs. But like, do we need as many in-house creative as we have? Do we need as many in the warehouse as we have? Do we need all the systems to support? Lord knows. I mean, there's just... I feel like there is a sect of e-commerce that's still trying to build Fortune 500 model companies. That's just not going to be sustainable in this day and age. With as much as it costs to get to your customer, with as much as it costs, we're going to hit with import costs. You have to find affordability somewhere. And I think a lot of that is going to be in your operations. On the other piece, you said it amazingly well just now. It's the, how did you phrase that?
The limiting belief. It's one of those kind of self-development theories where we go, well, I can't possibly be on a stage, or I can't possibly do that myself, or I can't. And I just think sometimes it also comes into how you structure a business. Like, well, of course I need an accounts team. Of course we have to invoice after we've done all the work. And sometimes you just need someone to go to show you how things are done elsewhere to help you shift those, yeah, those curtains. And I often think when you're taking over a business or you're entering a business as an employee, even one of your roles in the first couple of months for the benefit of that business is to break the limiting beliefs.
Yeah. So my takeaway recently on the A/B testing side, and as it pertains to those limiting beliefs, is that, and again, I don't know if I'm going to piss some people off here, because I have a lot of good friends in the development space and the agency space, and I think they're amazing people and I think they do amazing work. But I think we have brands that go in and spend $80,000, $200,000 on the retheme and then just let the retheme sit and don't test on top of it because, well, I just paid all this money to the agency to do this amazing work. And if I do want to test, well, really, shouldn't I be having the agency run the test because they know what the aesthetic should be and they know what the front end design is and, oh, this font, it doesn't entirely match, so I shouldn't do it, and the colors and the pixel perfection. And I think that's where I was before this most recent spell of, well, I'm not equipped to do the testing because I paid an agency. But now Shopify and frankly, like ChatGPT have made it so easy to change CSS, to do all these things that it's like, really, well, why can't I do it? I've always had imposter syndrome my entire career, but I've never had that limiting belief, as you're saying. Like, I always would be one to get in the weeds and do the work and really test and do. But when it came to actual A/B testing, like, I was really just at the tip of the iceberg. And I think a lot of that is wise because, like, we work with these agencies that are amazing. Like, don't get me wrong, but like, they're not doing the day-to-day testing that we should be doing. And like I said, I think there's so many opportunities now to just play with things. And if you can't figure it out, just, I started a website for my, like, I'm a builder, like I have to. And I've had this little spell in between full-time jobs. And so I like, I was so bored, I made my wife start a company. So my wife's a thrifter, an amazing thrifter. Maybe that might be for the tip later too. Another tip. But my wife's a thrifter and she finds these amazing things. And I was like, we need to start a website. We need to sell more across the country with what you thrift, as opposed to like the local marketplaces. And so I built a Shopify site for her. And then there were things she wanted me to change on the site and I didn't know how to do it. And I literally just like asked AI and it gave me the CSS and I plugged it in and it was like super easy. And I was so proud of myself. While I was doing that, there were changes I would have made to other websites I've worked on in the past that I just didn't, because I was like, I don't know, I was scared to, because it was managed by people smarter than me. But I think I don't have that limiting belief anymore. I don't think.
So is fixing that in this new business that you're going to take on, is embracing this full-on testing scenario, is it about the team's mentality? Is it about Ian getting in there and running a load of tests? Is it about building stronger, less siloed relationships with the agencies and the other teams that are the outsourced people who are working on it? Would you tackle it top down or kind of bottom up culture shift?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Like, because I do think, I mean, you're in this 20, 30, 40 million dollar range, like you still need agencies, right? Like my Shopify site crashes, I need someone like server side, whatever it may be, like I need help. So it's not that the agencies don't have a role anymore, but I think it has to be interwoven between, like, we're not going to wait on agency sprints and the internal team is going to test, and like we're going to have a good ecosystem of communication there. I mean, if I'm acquiring a brand, then like I should probably be the one doing all the testing if I'm doing a lot of other things. But like, yeah, I mean, I think it needs to be a culture of testing, and I think that goes across the board, right? Like it needs to be a culture of testing in finance. It needs to be a culture of testing in email marketing. It needs to be a culture of testing in product. So I mean, I think that's both building an ecosystem and a culture of testing in-house, but then how do you take that to your agency partners and say like, okay, I'm not afraid to try XYZ. And I feel like I've always been pretty good about that. I think people who've worked with me would say like on media buys, like I'm always piloting things, always trying different things. But I think for whatever reason, again, on like the front end web piece, was not good at that.
It is so much easier, I think, to test when you're doing media buys than it is to test on the website, because it's a lot easier to work out what to test. It's very easy to create a culture of, it's not very easy to create a culture of testing. It's relatively easy to create a culture of testing in a business and to encourage everybody to be doing testing. What's harder is to get a culture of testing and testing behavior happening that leads to good results. So, you know, people working out of the 20 ideas I've got, which are actually worth testing.
Sure.
You know, like changing a button color, probably not. Changing your Facebook graphics, probably. Doing some customer research to lead into better email content, probably worth doing. So what I'm trying to say is I think there has to be an element of Ian as the person who's taken over the business being involved in helping create the testing or agreeing the testing activity and monitoring the results as that builds, probably.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do it. You're right. No, I think you're right. I don't want to embarrass ourselves like how old we are, but I think we're relatively the same age and we came up around so relatively the same time as a marketer. And I think we all got duped by like that narrative of like Facebook tested the color of its blue, you know, and that was the A/B test. And so that's what we're all going with. Like, I'm going to try a red checkout button and I'm going to try a black checkout button and let's see which one wins. And like, yeah, that's the most baseline, you know, under baseline of like A/B testing. So, I mean, I think like, yeah, I think someone needs to, but to your point, like the person at the top needs to be the one driving how creative or how out of the box or how dynamic do we want to be in our testing? Do we want to be as surface level as I'm going to test a red versus a green button? Or do I want to be as, you know, be testing free shipping? To what level do we need to get to offer free shipping? What upsells do we want to offer? What free gifts do we want to offer? Where are things placed on the page? Do we want to get rid of the entire homepage and have them just land on nothing but a product grid? I mean, there's a lot of conversation out there about how like how PDPs are dying. But yes, to your point, yeah, that needs to come from the top down of how dynamic do we want to be in testing across the board.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are.
Running ads across a broad channel mix, but unsure where to invest your next pound? Alvi helps e-commerce experts like you with full funnel attribution, budget allocation, and automated bidding towards real business outcomes, so you can stop guessing and start scaling. Take children's clothing retailer POP, for example, who saw a 27% increase in average order value after implementing Alvi's bidding signals. Do you want similar results? Then go to ecmp.info/Alvi and book your demo. Make sure you add the note e-commerce master plan when you book to get your 3-month free trial. That's ecmp.info/Alvi to book your demo. ecmp.info/Alvie.
It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our business to the next level. So, Ian, are you ready to spill the tips you've been teasing us with all episode? Okay, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
I've been, I think it's my fifth or sixth time doing a podcast with you, so I don't remember all the books I've recommended. But I don't think I've recommended Unreasonable Hospitality. So just a really good book, just The Bear, especially now, like we're all watching The Bear and everything, just, you know, what it takes to be hospitable. This is like the book is set in a restaurant. It's about a chef and just what he did, you know, to create hospitality in his restaurant as he looked to get, you know, Michelin stars, etc. But yeah, just Unreasonable Hospitality, what it takes, you know, in terms of customer service, how to deal with your consumer as well. So yeah, a good book for people in sales, marketing, really anyone who just wants to make people happy.
Nice. I've not heard of that one, and I still haven't watched The Bear either. So that's a couple of big to-dos for me. Traffic top tip. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
I'll be honest. This one just stumped me. I feel like I've said them all. Again, I don't recall if I said this one last time, but we were doing something cool at Industry West where we were taking out billboards on trucks in Manhattan. So there's a company, and gosh, the name escapes me right now, but there's a company that work with the truck companies throughout the tri-state area, particularly in the metro area in New York, and they just rent the billboard space out on the side of the truck. So you have a truck in Manhattan that's delivering, or knows what it's delivering. It's not delivering our furniture. It could be delivering produce. It could be delivering anything, but people think it's your truck because it's skinned with your brand on it. And they've done a lot of cool things. And so it was really cool. I mean, it's cool to see the truck around New York. And there's also some other aspects where you can like IP target people within like 100-foot range of the truck or something. But yeah, so I would say, yeah, just I think, and we did, again, like piloting anything. We did digital billboards in Times Square. And I think people are like, billboards or did you know that sort of thing, but I mean I think it's everything old becomes new again, and I think there's cool things out there to do.
So much so, and I love that you have told us the trucks in Manhattan one before, but it's so good it deserves retelling.
Right.
Because oh no, don't apologize, because one of my favorite things about it is the social proof element.
Yes,
you know, it creates, admittedly fake, but it does create an element of, oh, well, if they're delivering a lot in Manhattan, then they must be for Manhattan people. And I'm a Manhattan person, so I need their products. It's clever. And you could replicate it in any city, village, however small. Maybe not as easily as the truck company who are already selling the spaces, but you could do it anywhere. Love it.
Yeah.
And let's face it, not enough e-commerce businesses do stuff offline.
That's true.
We should do more of that. Okay, tool top tip. Maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
Have you heard of this thing called AI yet?
Don't you mean A1?
A1, oh yeah, oh gosh. Yeah, but AI aside, so for on the A-B testing front, I've used Visually, V-I-S-U-A-L-L-Y. So it's a super cool A-B testing tool. It plugs like literally right into Shopify. It grabs your entire theme in like 30 seconds. is this is a really cool tool if you're looking at A/B testing. So I would, it's super efficient. You don't need to work with devs on it. So I would recommend that. But all joking aside on the AI piece, I still think like most marketers are really just like skinning the iceberg or tip of the iceberg, or however you want to say it, skinning the surface with how we're using AI just in our day-to-day jobs. And like I mentioned, I mean, just generating CSS for your website, like you don't like where a button looks, like, you know, the size, whatever, like ask ChatGPT and it'll like tell you what theme you're running. And it'll, I mean, obviously if we're running custom themes, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do that. And I think just really taking advantage of AI, and I think is really interesting. So yes, AI keeps me much more efficient, ChatGPT, and but on the A/B testing, I would recommend Visually.
Nice. So last one, the carbon top tip. What's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
I know I've given this answer before, and I really don't have any. With the past 10 years being in furniture, it's really difficult to talk about how many carbon, you know, a lot of ways we've saved in terms of carbon. And we definitely tried to be efficient in terms of packaging and tried to be efficient just in how limiting waste. I mean, I think the biggest piece for furniture companies is to the extent that you can, like don't have people return things. It's not cost efficient for them. It's not a cost efficient for you most of the time. It's just like, let them have it. If it's slightly damaged, like let them have it and have them resell it and keep it, you know, but without, you know, the extra packaging, without the extra gas and whatever to get it back to the warehouse. So I know that's something we did. So yeah, I would say just to the extent, if you can afford to eat and return, eat the return and don't have the extra fuel in the air from carbon in the air from that return.
Yeah, it's one of those which is becoming increasingly debated, even in areas like fashion. Should we actually ask for that to be returned? When you get into the numbers of it, it has surprising results when you start considering, should we actually ask for that to be sent back? Is it worth it? On both the finance side and the carbon side as well. So a weird one, a counterintuitive one, because I think we always went, I want the product back.
Yeah.
But it can be hugely powerful.
I mean, and there's a customer loyalty aspect as well.
Well, yeah, it's like, exactly. It's like most customers are not going to be annoyed by you telling them they don't have to traipse to the post office.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Okay, so Ian, before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can get in touch if they've got questions or want to chat?
Yeah, I am on LinkedIn. There's a lot of Ian Leslie's on LinkedIn. It's really weird, but I'm the one who's CMO. There are most of them are CMOs. So if you look me up on LinkedIn, I'll be there. I'm on Twitter at IR Leslie. That's pretty much where to find me right now.
And I know you're doing contracting at the moment. Are you also looking for jobs? Do you want to do a pitch for that?
Yeah, do some contracting both in e-commerce and higher ed right now. Like I said, I've been told recently a lot often that I am a builder. So if anyone needs help building something, I'm all ears.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ian. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you. And thank you for being our first What Would You Do guinea pig. You've been a star.
Exciting. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to catch up with Ian. And I loved the simplicity, but complexity, dare we say it, of his approach to taking over a $10 to $25 million business. Look, approach it in two ways. First off, overhead. What that isn't marketing, sales, or product can we cut cost down? Where can we cut the cost to create more cash that we can spend in our bootstrapping mindset on our marketing, our sales, and our product to improve the performance of the overall business? And then to test. Obviously, a lot of CRO, lots of marketing, lots of messages, so on and so forth. And it's a very simple plan, but it's also, I think, the only plan you could follow to get that hockey stick growth whilst you're bootstrapping. But also, it's so easy to take over a business arrogantly thinking you know what is needed. But if you're not doing the testing, you're not actually learning what's needed to take the next step growth. And really interesting to hear all his tips and tricks around testing and the things he's been learning of late and over time. So very cool to have Ian on the show. You can get your hands on the notes from this episode, including those top tips and the links to what we mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. Or you can use our direct episode short links. Just put ecmp.info/the number of this episode into the URL bar, and you'll be redirected straight to the right episode page. When you get to the website, you can also add yourself to our email list so you don't miss out on any of the other things I share to help you improve your business. If you liked this episode, then Couple of recommendations for you today. First off, check out episode 521, which is our previous episode with Ian, where we're chatting about a 90% B2B e-commerce revenue jump that he and his team had achieved. Super cool episode, loads of marketing tips in that one. Secondly, episode 557, where I got to chat with Sanya and Janice about building better, stronger relationships with your agency. I'm adding it into this one because to me, it resonates with that silo and culture of testing piece that I was talking to Ian about. So if you want more on that specifically, and building those testing, thriving relationships with, in particular, your agency, but also other marketing agencies, outsource people, et cetera, then go and have a listen to episode 557 as well. It was just a few episodes ago. And then if you want to catch up with all our What Would You Do episodes, so admittedly, this is the first one, but we have added a few similarly themed episodes to the page already. So if you go to the website via ecmp.info/WWYD, what would you do? Then you will be able to access a page where we'll be compiling all our What Would You Do episodes. And also, as I said, get your hands on a couple which fit the format but weren't technically WWYDs. Right, if that's not confusing enough, let's wrap it up. Thank you for tuning in to this and every episode that you do of the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I bring you a new interview every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including progressing along that path to net zero. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Have a great week and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.
Parcel Post Expo is the industry's global meeting place. This September, it returns to London for the first time in 17 years. For 2026 only, the event is taking place alongside E-commerce Expo, the UK's biggest e-commerce event on the 23rd and 24th of September. At Parcel Post Expo, discover the latest delivery technology, hear industry-leading insights at the Leadership Conference, and explore new ideas across the innovation labs. Whether you're a postal operator, parcel carrier, or part of the wider e-commerce ecosystem, Parcel Post Expo brings the global industry together in one place. Register for your visitor pass today at ecmp.info/parcelpost. See you there.